Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to another episode of But Why, the podcast that's all about digging into big questions and tricky topics via honest conversations. This week is not only the end of a series, it also happens to be our 100th episode, so we thought we'd try something a bit different. My producer Steve, who is the host of phenomenally successful podcast You, Me and the Big C, is going to interview me. I'm just saying off mic, I feel extremely nervous actually about this and massively unprepared.
There's no need to, Clammy. I'll be gentle.
Oh, well, you know, there's definitely a safety in hiding in the role of the host because you're in control.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. But you see, I've sat here now for the best part of 100 episodes and I've listened to you interview all these amazing people, have these incredible conversations. And yeah, I said to you the other week, didn't I, that I just think it's about time we found out a little bit more about you.
Shit.
Should we just crack on? Should we just get into it? Because
yeah, go for it.
Because every time you've asked your guest, you know, your first three questions, I've often thought to myself, I wonder what Clemmie's favourite crisp actually is.
My favourite crisp.
Hang on. I haven't asked you yet. Hold the horses. So, how are you really? What star sign are you? And what's your favourite crisps? And we'll also do, because you chucked this in a couple of times, have you got a secret talent or party trick?
Okay, how am I really? I am actually physically totally broken. We have done, it's the second week of the Easter holidays, and Ben and I have done a kind of 12-hour days of DIY and parenting. But we moved into our kitchen last night, which is like 5 years of dreams come true. So I'm exhausted but happy.
Exhausted but happy. What's your star sign?
Well, you don't care, Steve, but I will humour myself with this.
yeah, I can't even pretend to be that bothered.
But some people, you know, do.
We'll ask it anyway.
Okay, you can zone out, but for the listener who might be interested, I am a Pisces, so top line on that. Emotional, creative, yeah, quite prone to fantasy and dreamy. My rising is Libra, and again, top line Libra kind of traits are trying to be quite balanced, quite fair, quite bothered about appearances and make things look easy. And then my moon sign, my internal dialogue is Aries, which is very fiery, very driven. And that's quite at odds with how I sometimes appear in the world. But there you go.
I might not be into it, but I am quite interested in why you are. Why and when did you get into your astronomy?
I definitely started out as a kind. Well, I think if you grew up in our generation with like magazines aimed at teenage girls, there was always an astrology section, and you just read it because why not? And I think that version of astrology was rubbish. And then I started to learn a bit more about it. And when I thought it was rubbish, and I definitely did. And off mic, we've just been talking about how I like hippie stuff, but I also like things that make sense to me. And then the more I understood it began to make too much sense. And this isn't like, oh, everybody born in February is the same. There's so much more nuance to it. And since the beginning of time, one of the only things that we had to guide us was like where we sit in the universe, like physically. And I think it would be really naive to think that that has no impact on the way things are.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think maybe our generation, or me anyway, we're kind of put off a little by your Mystic Megs and all that kind of thing. That was, it was kind of a thing of a bit of ridicule, wasn't it, back in the day? Mm-hmm.
But like forever, people have used our place in the solar system as a reference point. But actually, we should just take a moment. Mystic Meg died very recently.
Yeah, she did. Yeah,
she did. Bless her. She was, she might have been all right. I think that the way it was distilled to us wasn't right. But yeah, I mean, I think again we've done podcasts on it. If you know a bit more in other cultures, like I think it's particularly Italians, it's very part of the common rhetoric to ask people, what their birth chart looks like.
And what's your favourite crisp? Now this is a big one because you often get into the crisp dialogue, and actually we spend more time typically on the crisps than we do about the how are you really and the what star sign are you questions. But I've never really got a grasp on what is your favorite crisp.
I was going to say I've never met a crisp I don't like kettle chips. That is the only top line. But my absolute favorite crisp is the most boring answer of all time is a ready salted Walkers.
Wow, that is a really standard boring crisp.
Just so delicious.
Wow, I didn't expect you to say that actually.
You thought I was going to get something a bit more wanky.
Well, I did, yeah. I wondered if it might be a bit funky.
Well,
What is it about a ready salted Walkers that does it for you?
Well, it's just absolutely fail-safe. It's just, it goes with anything. It's just delicious. I do like, if I was to choose a more wanky crisp, it would be those Torres black truffle ones.
Oh, they're good, aren't they?
They're so good. But
they are good.
I think in the end you'd get sick and just be happy with the Walkers.
Yeah, truffle can be a bit rich if you... This is such a middle-class conversation, isn't it?
Yeah,
truffle
can
be a bit... Oh, dear. As I said it, I was thinking I shouldn't... Yeah, no, yeah. Have you got a secret talent or party trick?
I feel like... Oh, yeah, I have actually.
Go on. This is exciting.
I can fit a whole packet of Chew-Its in my mouth at once.
Do you know what? If we had more time and access to Chew-Its, I'd be asking to do it right now.
I actually once did a live on it on Instagram and then really instantly regretted it because it's actually quite a dribbly state of affairs. And the fitting it in is one thing. Then chewing it to digest it...
A whole packet of Chew-Its. Wow, that's incredible. We're only 9 minutes and 22 seconds in, and I found out so much that I did not know about you.
There you go.
Ready salted crisps and an obsessive Chew-It eater. Mm. I did actually look you up, Clemmy.
Oh, no.
Because you did this to me when I was on the podcast. And you were described as... you were described as a... creative director / Instagrammer / blogger / podcaster / author / fitness fanatic and a mum of three. Other than being a mum, mm-hmm. which bit of that is your favourite or gives you the most satisfaction?
Good question. I wouldn't be without any of them because that's exactly the way I need to run my life is to have all of those bits. I would be torn between fitness and podcasting, which sit at very different ends of that, but they're the two bits that bring me the most, and motherhood, obviously.
How do they all kind of work together? Because presumably the creative director bit came first, did it? And then the rest of it kind of flowed from that.
Yeah, I think, yes. My career was, is an agency creative director, as a copywriter and writing ads. And this was in the mid-2000s when like TV ads were such an important part of culture. If you think of some of the stuff when we were growing up, Levi's ads, Tango ads, they were...
The Levi's huge ads. Do you remember them with the Spaceman song and that kind of thing?
And that little yellow puppet kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Flat Eric.
Flat Eric, yeah.
And Tango, do you remember there was a, they did a really kind of modern bit of advertising where you could ring a phone line and talk to, because you have you been tangoed? And I think the guy just came and beat someone up in a, I can't really remember.
Well, there was the tangoed advert, the You've Been Tangoed one that got banned in all the schools because you used to run up behind someone and whack their ears.
Yeah.
And that was You've Been Tangoed, and it got banned in all the schools because everyone was getting it, you know, ear problems.
But that was it. That was like advertising in those days was such, was huge cultural references. You know, there were the big moments. And so when I went into it, making a TV ad just felt phenomenally exciting. It was the best career I could have possibly have dreamed of. But then by the time I had my kids, I'd started out on Instagram, and this had, and what started as a kind of fun, something to do and connect me to people when I was on maternity leave, suddenly blew up into another version of my career. And so I couldn't help but give that a go. Although interestingly, I'm now trying to go back into agencies to take a bit of what I've learned on social media and bring it back into advertising. But that wasn't your question. What was your question?
I can't even remember what it was. You know what? We'll get into a bit of the Instagram stuff in a little while, but I wanted to know a little bit about young Clemmy. So because we've sort of touched on it over the course of the podcast when we've talked about things like sobriety and, you know, anxiety. Maybe we've touched on elements of your childhood, elements of your youth. But can you introduce us all to young Clemmy and tell us a bit about what you were like growing up?
Yes, I always start editing myself here because I know my mum will listen and have an opinion, and my mum is also extremely sensitive, so I don't want to ever insult her. Who was I when I was young? Actually, my daughter has been a very good reminder of me to know what I would have been like. I think she represents a lot of who I was, which is very creative, very spirited, very messy, always up to something. A busybody, probably, definitely. I'm an eldest of five, so kind of very much a bit of a kind of mini matriarch role, even from when I was young, organising my brothers and sisters, and definitely just sitting in that older sister role that I feel perhaps is what translates into my work now. It's trying to look after a body of people, impart some wisdom, but it probably occasionally be a bit annoying as well.
How do you think your siblings would answer that question? What are they? What do you think they made of Mummy Clemmy?
Equal parts with affection and with affection, but yeah, definitely annoying. Definitely annoying. I've got a tendency to be bossy, and I've got a tendency, which I've worked really hard to move away from, of finding comfort in being quite controlled and knowing what's going on and having a plan. But I'm trying to flex that a bit more as I get older.
I'm interested in the sobriety thing. Mm-hmm. What about your youth do you think kind of led you down that path?
I'm cringing because I've just very quickly got a kind of kids of the 90s vision of like alky pops I find it really interesting to unpick all this. So my relationship with alcohol was absolutely of a generation. I think I grew up with the influence of kind of ladette culture and if girls can keep up with the boys, and definitely I've got kind of tendencies where I like to get involved and get stuck in, and I probably would have been called a tomboy in lots of ways, you know. And so it was very natural for me to try and sink the pints at the same rate as the boys. Again, I've touched on it, but I worked in advertising. It's a definite work hard, play hard industry. We had a free bar on a Thursday night.
Wow.
It was a lot about getting drunk and partying, and none of it I thought was abnormal. But if I reflect at uni, I would quite often drink to the point of not being able to remember stuff, and that was something we joked about, you know. Oh, I don't remember what I did between, don't remember getting home. And the further I come back from that, the more that makes my palms sweat, because I think of the like risky situations I put myself in, and also what on earth you're doing to your liver and your brain if you get to points where it's shut down. But really, aside from the regret of behaviour, and again, it's nothing terrible, it's just not a person that I want to be now, I also ended up getting crippling anxiety when I drank. And I often say that we are very like versed in saying, oh, I can only have two coffees and it, or it makes me jittery. For me, I got to the point, if I had like one drink, I would have crippling self-loathing and terrible anxiety the next day. And I became so obsessed with trying to manage that. Ben was talking about it the other day. He's like, before you gave up drinking, like 24 hours before we went out, and again, when I say going out, by this point I had three kids, so I wasn't like out. I would be like, right, well, we must leave at 10, and I would try and like drink water obsessively, all to avoid feeling awful the next day. And then I just had this light bulb moment of this mitigating feeling terrible is not worth the drink. So let's have a go at giving it up. And I didn't expect it to be the life shift that it was, but I honestly think it's the single best thing that I've ever done for myself. Yeah.
So interesting talking about the 90s, because I, you know, we're of a similar age. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit older, I think, aren't I? But talk about like the late 90s, the early 2000s. You know, going out and getting drunk every single weekend, you know, at university every single weekend. But I look back now, maybe like with the wisdom of being a 40 something. And I remember going to, you know, going out on nights out and some nights where you turn up a bit later or something, everyone else has already been out for a while and you're a bit later, and you have to, you know, play catch up, we used to call it. So you used to sink as many drinks as you could to try and get to the level of everybody else. And I think, if I look back now and I think to myself, like, what was I actually trying to do with that? What was the point of that? Was I completely unable to have a good time until I was at the level of everybody else? And you look back now and you think that says a lot actually about your kind of state of mind back then, doesn't it? That you and your confidence, your self-esteem, your, you know, all that kind of thing, that you weren't, you know, I think an awful lot of people would have been the same, that we weren't able to have a good time until we felt like we'd reached a certain level.
Completely. It's really odd, because I think that the thing that kept me drinking, and actually I have messages about this all the time, people are like, oh, but I don't want to look boring if I don't drink.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
I mean, what, when you actually pack that down, unfortunately, because I used to tell myself, oh, you know, I'm really fun when I drink. That's the real me being unleashed. No, it's not. The person who's a little bit more gossipy and a lot more extrovert, if I edit them when I'm stone cold sober, that is really the person that I want to show up with in the world. And yes, there is a little sweet spot, especially, you know, in the height of parenting, where you have a drink and it like just relaxes the shoulders enough. And that is the bit that I craved. But to dance that line, you know, it's very difficult. And I think, for me, in the first bit of being sober, it was learning how to socialise sober. Now, I'd done it when I was pregnant, but you're kind of in a different headspace then. But I'd been drinking on a night out since I was 16 or 17. It's like I went from kind of kids' parties to any version of adult socialising was with a drink in my hand, which is wild.
Yeah, it is. And I think, like you say, it is quite generational. Interesting a term that you just used then, which pops up a lot in our conversations on this podcast, is the real me. And it's an interesting concept, though, isn't it? What is the real you? Mm-hmm. And whether there is there actually a real you, or is the real you just the version of you that you want it to be the most, or what would you say the real you is? Who is that person now, and perhaps, you know, compared to who it was going back 15, 20 years?
Well, we often joke that the real me is a little bit more boring. And I actually, again, have learned that that is excellent. Like, I thought I was definitely always craving excitement and fun. And now the older you get, or the older I get, the more I find joy in comparatively mundane things. But so often I'd be like, oh, I should go out. I should do this. But if you take all the shoulds out, and if I can, again, sticking on the drinking theme, if I can only go and have a good time when I've had three Proseccos, and actually if I didn't have three Proseccos, I wouldn't want to hang out there, then that means that, yeah, it's not the right thing. But the real me is probably more introvert. I love a deep and meaningful chat. And
so, like, were you drinking, do you think, to get away from that introverted person, because you didn't want to be that person?
Well, I just the thing is, I can be very extrovert, but only with people I know very well, which I think is probably, the older I get, the more I think there aren't many true extroverts. Most people are more comfortable in smaller groups and not being in the spotlight. So I think I was drinking, to give myself confidence. You're right, it's self-esteem.
Interesting, isn't it? Did you always want to become a mum? Was that always the plan?
Well, it's interesting. Because of that being the eldest of five, we've got an episode out yesterday, haven't we, Steve, which is about women without children.
Yeah.
And when I was preparing for that podcast with Ruby, I was thinking, did you ever stop to think? Did you ever decide that this was your path? Or I just absolutely, like so many of us, just did the thing that I thought I was going to do. And of course, it's an absolute gift, but I didn't think about the reality of it. But yeah, I did always want to be a mum.
And you always wanted to have I guess maybe like being one of five, was it always a plan to have a big family?
Yeah, I thought I was going to have four. I really did. And then I had three. And I'm doing this interview with Steve. He's going to become a dad of three next week.
By the time people are listening to this, I will be a dad of three, whereas as we're recording, I'm a dad of one. That's a bit mad,
isn't it? Oh, my word. Yeah. But once we had three, that I knew that there was no part of us, our relationship, our finances, our capacity that could have any more. You know, I didn't have anything more to give to anyone else. But I did always, I wanted that rabble that I had when I was growing up. But I definitely am aware that the bigger the family you have a massive gift in terms of always having people to play with and a whole crew and that full house feeling. But you can't then give each respective child the individual attention that they would have if they're in a smaller family. So it's a payoff, isn't it?
Yeah, we're actually having that with Freddie at the moment, my 7-year-old. We're trying to explain to him that it's going to be different when the twins arrive. And actually after this podcast, we're going out for a nice little day out, me and him together, just to have some quality time before it all goes a bit crazy. Because it's got to be hard for a 7-year-old to understand that for the first 7.5 years of your life, you've been the be all and end all in daddy's life. And then all of a sudden, he will always be that, but with other people, butting in on the attention a little bit. And that's got to be quite difficult. How did you kind of cope with that when you had your second and your third child?
It's definitely difficult. But actually, we were talking yesterday, Ben and I, about the value of siblings. You know, our kids are doing a lot of... My third, Greta, is now five. So she is definitely a contender in the battles. You know, before she was always a little one. There's now three of them vying for, the constant negotiations about what they're watching on TV, who's sitting in what seat, what meal they should have for lunch, And there's so much value in that, learning to deal with conflict, learning, to negotiate. So, but that might not feel like a gift to them at that moment, but it will do in the long term. So, but it's difficult for the age gap between my boys is only 22 months. And I look back at Bertie just before Woody was born. I was like, oh, you didn't really have much of a stint at being the number one guy in our life. And actually then he went to school and Woody got some time on his own. And then the boys went to school and Greta got some time on their own. And I actually feel like, yeah, Bertie, my eldest, got the least, but that's probably me projecting because I'm the eldest and I know what it is to kind of keep being shared out. But ultimately he's going to have some siblings soon. It's going to be amazing.
Yeah. He's looking forward to it. You mentioned Ben a few times. Mm-hmm. How does Ben fit into this puzzle that is Clemmy? How does, when did you meet Ben and what's, you know, perhaps introduce us a bit to Ben. We don't really know much about Ben.
Okay. I met Ben when I was, I think, I don't know. Actually, it's our 15 or 16.
Romantic.
15 or 16.
I met him when I was,
24, 20. I was drunk when I met him, and that Ben and I partied together very hard. I think I was around 23, 24. Yeah. I think next week is our 16 years of being together, not being married. Ben and I share a similar characteristic. He's an Aries, for those that are listening. We are both very, when we decide to do something, we do it. And I think actually often to our detriment, like we've done two big house renovations. We've knocked out the children. We're a go, go, go couple. But how Ben is very different from me, and I think probably where I was initially attracted to him, is that he is not an overthinker. He is a kind of glasses always half full, sometimes really very annoyingly, to be honest, the eternal optimist. And that's actually funny because we used to always argue when we're going on holiday, he is so excited, like a child, like giddy, giddy, giddy. And I was just like, you know, the opposite end of the scale, always a bit anxious on the traveling day, trying to get everything organized. And he could never understand why I was so finding him annoying. And then now, particularly our middle child, Woody, is very much like him and on the ceiling on holiday days. And I'm like, here you go. Here we are. The mirror is being shone back at you. He's like, why is he so all over the shop? I'm like, this is it. This is what it's been like being married to you. Ben is a very good counter to my overthinking, overanalyzing, want to talk everything through mind.
Has he always been on board with you sharing everything about your life so openly and honestly on your social media and things?
It's a constant check-in. I think when he would question it is when it's been to the detriment of me. There was a time when I got very weighed down in, you know, those trolling sites and definitely had a massive impact on my mental health for a bit. And so therefore he would probably wish that that wasn't being inflicted on me or that I had inflicted that on myself, I guess, by opening up. But we have an ongoing dialogue about where the boundaries are. You know, my kids aren't on there anymore, although I put a video up this week where you can see them. And before I posted it, I was like, can you see their faces? Could you identify them? And he's like, no, that's fine with me. When, you know, we've had times, of course, we've been married 12 years or coming up to 13 years, and we've had some really, really rough times. And I've tried to shine a light on that sometimes so that people know that, you know, marriage is tough. But I've always tried to do that in a way that is respectful to us without sharing too much of the dirty laundry in public, but also be honest. It's quite a line to dance, I suppose.
Yeah, but I think that was actually going to be one of my next questions about, you know, what is it that maybe when you did start sharing your story that you thought maybe was so relatable to people. And I think it probably is that warts and all thing. You know, I had that with Rachel, and my first wife, and, you know, people like Dame Deborah James. Sorry, Deb. It was warts and all. It wasn't just the good bits. It was the really challenging bits as well. do you think that's maybe the case? And if so, kind of what, what do you think it maybe is that when you did start sharing your story, it really grabbed people's attention?
I think the core value across everything is honesty, 100%. You know, when I started out on Instagram, and it's interesting to reflect on that time now, 7 years ago, I'd had two kids very quickly, and I'd found the first year of parenting, like everybody, impossibly hard, but also incredibly lonely. I'm the eldest of my siblings, so none of them had kids. I was the first of my friends. I literally knew no one with kids. And I'd had this big career, and suddenly I was at home, not really knowing who I was, not really knowing what I was doing. And then when I had my second quite quickly, and that's when Instagram started, it was a real shift. I found all these people, all, you know, Zoe, dressed like a mum, Steph, don't buy her flowers, and Mumsy Mum, Anna, Mother Pucker, all coming through. And I was using it to go, oh my word, motherhood's amazing, but it's really, really hard. And that dialogue feels really obvious now, but in beforehand, it really wasn't. There was only parenting books. There wasn't an honest dialogue around parenting. And so as soon as I started sharing the difficult bits, people started sharing them back with me. And now we're in a world where we talk about engagement and community. Honestly, all I was wanting to do is save myself and find people who would talk about the reality of it, find some friends, fill the days, because, you know, my first maternity leave was literally going to Boots, coming home, going and buying a slice of cake. Didn't know what to do with myself. But the problem with honesty as a kind of core value, and that translates on online and offline, is the knowing the boundaries of, I want to share an honest version of my life, but I don't want to leave myself vulnerable. And I think what the kind of trolling chapter that we're talking about was my first realization of needing to put more boundaries in than I first realized.
Let's just go back a little bit, because you talked then just a bit about some of the challenges. Let's get a little bit Elizabeth Day on this. What do you think have been your biggest challenges, your biggest, I don't want to say failures. Well, that's her thing, isn't it? We'll leave failures to her. What have been life's biggest challenges?
Oh, good one, Steve. One of the most challenging chapters was that early bit of motherhood. And I think as I have reflected on it, it was actually a lack of willingness to change. I think I truly believed I could be the person that I was before having kids. And the reality is, you've got to let that person go. And, you know, you can ease back towards that person afterwards. But I think I so wanted to keep my identity as everything I'd been as Clemmy without kids, that gripping onto a life that had gone was my undoing. You know, I was trying to still wear exactly the same clothes, I went back to work quite quickly when Bertie was 8 months old, tried to carry on this big career and act like I wasn't extremely sleep deprived, et cetera, et cetera. So, but as soon as I went, you know what, I'm a mum now. My life ultimately revolves around them. And then I piece myself back into that. That was the moment it stopped being this awful challenge.
We've actually just been through our NCT class, and for the second time for me, and amongst eight couples in the NCT class, I was the only person who'd had a child before. And it was actually really insightful to listen in on conversations between people who didn't have any idea what was coming, as someone who has a reasonable idea what's coming. You know, there was one chap who you know, quite understandably was talking about, you know, really wanting to get his, you know, their lives back to normal or introduce some normality as quickly as possible after the baby was born. You know, he said, you know, really hoping we can go for dinner within the first couple of weeks. And I'm just thinking, it's really hard to, hard to explain to you just how big this adjustment's going to be. And you know, try the first 2 months, you might get out once, probably not even, you know, it's really, really hard, but it was really interesting to, and I tried my hardest not to kill all their hopes and dreams, but it was really difficult not to, because I think your expectations before you have a child are quite unrealistic, and you only realize that once you get through the first year and you think, wow, I had no idea of the impact this would have.
No, I don't think you're right. I mean, actually, that is the joy of subsequent children. By the time we had Greta, I was like, well, we're not going to sleep for the next year. And then actually, every time we did get a decent night's sleep, that felt like a massive win. It's like, oh, yeah, like, we're not going out for dinner. And then lo and behold, when a window does come and you can go out for dinner, again, it's a victory. And it just is that total reframing. But yeah, after my second, we were in a soft play within 48 hours of me giving birth. And I was like, what are you doing?
Wow.
Because your adrenaline, this is the real difficult bit. You're so like loved up on oxytocin because you're new babies. You're so relieved not to be pregnant and to be the other side of labor. You do have this like huge adrenaline dump where you feel like you can do anything, but that doesn't last forever. And with Greta, I was absolutely vigilant. I did this a week in bed afterwards and a week on the sofa, no visitors. I think actually our parents kind of came, but I stayed in my pajamas so that it was like, treat me as if someone who've just had a major op, you know, you make the tea, I need to be taken care of. And it was blissful, you know, because the very nature of not having to work out what to wear, not having to think about the outside world, meant I could just focus on her. And then after 2 weeks, when I was significantly better recovered, I kind of went out. I feel ready.
It's interesting how we, we're watching, I don't know if you've seen This Is Us. Have you seen the series This Is Us?
God, it's so
we're halfway through season five, and and they just, what I love about that family is many things, but when the children are younger, like the chaos, they don't mind, you know, they have food fights, they have paint fights, they have what was it, a sequin fight at one point. And I haven't seen you have sequin fights, but it looks like your family is this sort of beautiful. You like that noise. You like that kind of like slightly organized, chaotic, you know, family kind of feel. Is that right?
Do you know what? Actually, the podcast we did with Dr. Shefali was on conscious parenting. For me, actually, really gave me a piece of language to talk about what I want. I really value manners and structures and being committed to projects and, you know, all those core values. But I feel really strongly that I want my kids to have a childhood where they can have fun and freedom. My childhood was at moments a little bit feral, but we did a lot of being out in the garden and, you know, making potions and dens, and probably doing some, we were talking about, we had a rope swing in the garden. It was realistically extremely dangerous, yet none of us ended up with broken limbs, you know. And actually the other day, Greta, who's my 5-year-old, was using a penknife to open a box, and I really want them to understand their own boundaries on risk and safety, because I think that's the only way you learn. I really don't want to be the one saying you must never touch that sharp knife, like within reason. I don't want you to slice your finger off, but the only way you realize that a knife is sharp is to, you know, possibly cut yourself. So yeah, I do like a lot of chaos, because I think that's where you learn so much of who you are. And all my siblings are really creative, and I do think that people, creativity as a skill is something you have to nurture, and that isn't done within really strict boundaries. One of my sons is really, really into baking, and the reality is it's really messy and annoying, but he made cinnamon buns from scratch, as in all the pastry, wow, all the dough, and he's taught himself that. And wow, I mean, they were delicious, and the only way he's done that is by me accepting that there's going to be a messy kitchen at the end of it. And and again, on that podcast, she was very clear. We can push our children all we like, you know, drive them to do all these clubs, but actually, if at home they're able to experiment and learn, and they will also develop into the people they're meant to be if you allow that.
You guys have moved the family out of London down to the beach recently. Before we start talking about the podcast, quickly on, do you think do you think London living was good for you? And B, what has been so wonderful about moving to the beach?
London living was really good for me for a chapter of my life. And actually, even right, like definitely when my career was, in my 20s, when socializing and my career and being wanting to be like very fingers on the pulse, it couldn't have been better. And I think actually early motherhood, it was great because you could walk out the door and there was stuff, you know, there were so many things to do. But as soon as my kids could kind of run around, I realized how deeply connected. I grew up in the countryside, and I, at the bit that I just described, that being muddy outside, I really hated not seeing my children have that. We had a tiny, tiny courtyard garden, and we could go to the park, but it's not that kind of free play. No. And my eldest two are boys, and honestly, all they want to do is kick a ball. All they want to do. And I was constantly telling them off for that, whereas actually, I want you to go outside and kick a ball. Of course I do, rather than be on the screen. So... unfortunately for us, we were trying to leave from like 2018, and then the pandemic, you know, what we hit. And so we had 2 years of actual pure hell, to be honest. Our house was far, far, far too small for us, and we were in lockdown. But it did mean by the time we did move the end of last year, there was no wobbles. You know, we were so desperate to leave. That it's been the best thing we ever did.
Let's move on to the podcast now, because we are 100 episodes in.
Yay!
This is number 100. Which, I don't know if this is asking you to pick your favourite child, but which conversations do you think, can you pick out any from the 100 or from the 99, or perhaps include this one, from the 100, that have been the most insightful or had the most impact on you?
So there's some that have stayed with me because they've been windows into worlds that fortunately I haven't had to experience myself. One on domestic abuse, one on child abuse, those kind of conversations, and that will always stay with me because they're just shocking. But the ones that have really stayed with me, I did an episode with Joe Westwood on codependency. And it's sometimes quite strange for me because this is a bit like a therapy session, and I'm sitting there having a conversation and suddenly understanding lots more about myself. So about people pleasing and kind of trying to over deliver to people, and that being a spiral of resentment. That was huge. Similarly, in the episode with Caroline on burnout and challenging yourself to not be scared of rest. And then episode on anxiety with, I can't remember her name, Ellen, Dr. Ellen. And her talking about how anxiety, we pin as a mental health thing, but actually it's to do with our body. And I really have found that to be true to myself, that particularly alcohol, what I was putting into my body was affecting my mental health. I know the same with if I don't look after what I'm eating. But all of those have been huge personal bits of the puzzle for me where I was like, okay, I'm understanding something more about myself. But on a kind of bigger picture, being able to talk to anyone for an hour with no interruptions feels like the ultimate luxury these days. It just doesn't happen. You know, even with I'm sitting with Ben or with my best friends or with my family, there's still a phone on the table. You know, your attention is constantly pushed to the outside world. I just love it.
The phone on the table thing is really interesting. I saw someone talking about this the other day, and I've really tried to stop doing it because somebody was saying that if you put your phone on the table, even if you look like you're talking to someone, you're telling them that there might be something that might be more important. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. The codependency episode is a really good one that you mentioned, actually, because I'm a massive people pleaser. And I think I'd probably always seen that as being a good thing. Amy calls me a golden retriever. You know, we've got a golden retriever in the house, Bodhi, and he likes to bring things to people. He likes to bring you a blanket. He's happy if everyone else is happy. My dad's exactly the same. He's happy if everyone around him is happy. You know, and all he wants to do is make other people happy and fix things for people, fix things that are going wrong. And I'm a little bit like that. And I always kind of saw it as being a really good thing. And I think, you know, in some ways it is, but I'd never really thought about it as being a negative before. And that episode was really interesting for me as well.
Has it changed you in any way? Have you like been more aware of where the boundaries are on that?
I've definitely been more aware of it. It's been very difficult with Amy being pregnant for the last 9 months. Your role as the other half is to kind of be a people pleaser. Mm. You know, you've got to be a punch bag at times. Mm-hmm. You've got to wait on them hand and foot because you know it's what Amy's found is it's not this Instagram movie version of pregnancy where people bound around, you know, looking beaming, looking like it's, you know, the best thing in the world. It's really hard, isn't it? And particularly with a twin pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Amy found it very difficult, particularly like the last trimester. She's been very uncomfortable. Today, for example, she's feeling rubbish, really, really uncomfortable, in a lot of pain. We're only a few days away from, you know, D-Day now. So she's feeling, she's not feeling great. And I think, so for the last 9 months, I have sort of been, I've had to do that role. But definitely going forward. And the idea of being selfish the other week, the idea of being selfish as being, you know, not a negative thing is something that I'd never really thought about. And such negative connotations to that word. Whereas actually all it means is looking after yourself. And there's nothing wrong with that sometimes.
It's so interesting. This week, there's two things I pulled out of. Both, one, watching my brother's gig, and two, doing a powerlifting competition tomorrow. And it is so uncomfortable for me to pull out of stuff because I just have this, letting people down, letting myself down. But I'm exhausted. I'm absolutely exhausted. And I knew that if I did both of those things, I would just push myself to a point that is quite harder to come back from. But it's so interesting that experience of saying no to stuff and why that feels bad. My brother doesn't mind. No, my brother would like me at his gig, but he ultimately doesn't mind. It was only me competing in this competition for me. But it's very difficult to learn, to know your limits on stuff, I think.
On the powerlifting thing, I meant to ask you this actually. What do you think that has given you? Because it's a really interesting thing, I think, that probably, well, I mean, you tell me, going back 25 years, 25-year-old, well, not 25 years, that's 15 years, isn't it? Sorry, not 50. Going back 15 years, would 25-year-old Clemmy have imagined that you'd be in powerlifting competitions?
I think she'd quite like it. I've definitely always been someone, as I said, who got stuck into stuff and had a go at things, but powerlifting has been pretty life-changing for a few reasons. Number one, we've touched on it a few times in the podcast, but I similarly in the 90s, I come from this era of diet culture and of of my single aim for many, many, many years of my life, in every aspect of my life, but particularly in food and exercise, was to be the skinniest, smallest version of myself at all costs. And in order to be strong, it's a different journey. I want my body to be, yeah, as strong as it can be, which means that where my body naturally wants to be, which isn't tiny, it's just healthy, is its optimum place. And that is just such a relief to go to the gym and not be trying to sweat as much as I can. It's to get stronger. And the other thing about powerlifting is it's a very, very, very slow journey. You do the same things over and over and over and over and over again, occasionally for gain, often not for gain. And again, from the way I am in a lot of things, I have in a more addictive personality trait, I want quick wins. I want that quick high. I used to do CrossFit, which is a kind of sweat, get a massive rush and do it again and again. Whereas this is like not many highs, lots of graft. And that kind of discipline is really useful for me, I think.
I'm going to finish with an interesting question. I only thought this morning, right, when I was tidying up a few bits of paper in my little office room, and there's a bit of paper that like a colouring a sheet that Freddie had in a restaurant last year. It wasn't just your regular kind of colouring sheet. It was a little bit deeper than that, and so it had some colouring on it, but it also had 5 things I like about myself.
Oh.
I thought to myself, I wonder what Clemmie would say if I said, give me 5 things that you like about yourself.
Oh my word. I've literally just covered my face with my hands. I find that an unbelievably triggering question, which is very revealing. I like my determination. I like my creativity. This is going to dwindle quite quickly. I like my resilience. I like my strength. Oh, and I like my humour. There we go.
Perfect.
Got there.
You got there. Okay.
It's a good question, Steve.
It's a good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is a good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I liked it. And it was really funny. I thought that it was, yeah, I'll show you. I mean, Freddie wrote, I'm 7 and I smell.
You should keep that. You should frame it.
But I'll show it to you now, but they had little 5 things I like about myself and a gratitude glass on a sheet from Piccolino. Piccolino restaurant is a chain, isn't it? But yeah, I liked it though.
Mm. I'm stealing that.
Before we go, where can people find you? And is there anything you want to shout about?
Oh, you're doing all my things. This is very
weird.
I'm doing
all your things.
I'm in a few places these days. I'm at Clemmie Telford on Instagram, but Why Podcast on Instagram, and also the Took Forever Home. We haven't talked about it that much, but I've been undertaking this monster renovation. And I'm documenting it on there. And also, I'm newly dabbling in LinkedIn, which is a wild but quite
LinkedIn's
fun
good.
Place. Yeah.
LinkedIn's good.
I'm obviously Clemmie Telford on there. Come on over. Yeah, that's all my things.
And if you could have an honest conversation with one person, who would it be and what would you say?
I think it's actually going to go full circle to where you began this. I would go back to whatever 10, 11, 12-year-old me, and say it's all going to be all right.
Well, that's a good answer.
I did a lot of very heavy therapy a year ago, EMDR, which is like reprocessing traumatic things. And my parents got divorced at 12, when I was 12, and it was very traumatic. And what kept on coming up in that therapy is me, adult me, walking into various traumatic moments from that time and taking 12-year-old me out of it. That's where my brain kept on going, which is really significant, I think. You know, yeah, I want to be the adult that that version of me needed. So that's my answer.
Perfect way to wrap it up. I've always wondered what you would say there. We've had different. We've had dogs. We've had kids. We've had dead parents. We've had all sorts of things over the time, haven't we? But that's interesting.
That's me. There you go. What a weird experience.
Thank you very much. How's it been?
Yeah, it's good. I worry I'm also going to cut myself to pieces now. I worry that I haven't given very considered answers, but I guess this is the whole point. You want the uncut version of me.
I think it was great. I'm just going to let it run and you can wrap this one up.
Oh no, okay. I can't remember how you end. I am actually just going to get my notes here. Bear with, listener. I mean, first of all, reflection on how that was. That was really exposing. And I don't know why, because I've obviously been a guest on lots of podcasts before. But usually that's under a certain topic. And also that is usually me in work mode. Either because I've been off this week or because it's Steve or because it's my podcast. You've just heard me be very much, I think, the person that my friends and family know, which I kind of try and put out online, but there are some definite boundaries around it, because although I want to be honest, I don't want to be vulnerable, and now I am going to feel really vulnerable. But that's good, it means you've done your job well. Let me know, get in touch at either ButWhy Podcast or ButWhy@clemmytelford.com, and let me know if you like this as a regular feature, if we do this at the end of every series, or if I can't sleep for the next week, we won't do it at the end of every series. probably a bit of both. Thank you very much for listening. As always, please do rate, review, subscribe, share it. We're always trying to get new listeners. And this is the last episode of this series. We'll be continuing to put out ButWhy Bite Size on a Monday. And we've got a little new series coming, a sub-series called Meet the Founder, where I have honest conversations with business owners. So that's going to sit between this series and Series 9, which will be with you shortly. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you, Steve, for putting me... put me in the hot seat.
I think I should say thank you to you, because I think it was a really, really insightful, interesting listen. So thank you.